What about the name?
We're going to have to pop a name in at the end because once again, I was delinquent in thinking of a name. So we'll come up. Take this job and shove it. Isn't that like a country song? We literally had a phone call to go over what we were talking about. We set it up. I sent you an agenda and now we're changing it, but go.
But I don't just.
Whatever. It's your show, Connor. We're just alone. Yeah.
It's all in the same spectrum.
Yeah, no.
We're talking about jobs.
I think spectrum is a perfect analogy for that. So I don't even get into that.
Yeah. Top jobs, the top full spectrum.
How about Connor on the spectrum?
Jesus Christ.
All right. Sorry. A little personal there.
Yeah. Jeez. All right. You ready, guys?
Ready.
Hey there, squash fans, and thanks for coming back to another episode of The Breakdown with myself, Connor O'Malley, my delightful yet discerning co-host, Bill Buckingham, and after another high demand from TBD fans, making another appearance is Paul Johnson, otherwise known as PJ, who we are thrilled to have back. In this episode, we were inspired by an article written on squashmad.com, written by Andy Whipp, who was talking about where ex-touring pros live after they retire from the circuit and the jobs that they take. This got us thinking about what kind of jobs are out there both in squash and other sports. After the show, stay tuned or just skip ahead for the fan follow-up and see if your name is mentioned. A quick thank you again to our sponsor, Baya Sports. They are both Bill and mine's favorite squash shoe ever because they feel great and they look great. And one of those big no-nos is we do sometimes wear them outside the house just because we like them so much. So go to BayaSports.us and check out their newest Force X. That's BayaSports.us. Thank you again for tuning in, and we hope you enjoy the show.
What about this?
This call is being recorded.
All right, welcome back to another episode of The Breakdown with my co-host, Bill Buckingham. We're very excited for another show here. And Bill, what episode is this?
Connor, I have no idea what episode this is. I have to be honest with you. We have had over the, as TBD, you four TBD fans out there have been wondering, where have you guys been? So I don't know what episode this is because we have recorded a full like hour and a half long episode that is disappeared into the ether, basically. So just know going forward, when this podcast inevitably explodes and is out there in the mainstream and everybody listens to it, we'll have like gold platinum members, we'll have silver members, and you pay a certain fee to get certain access to us. The people who pay the most money will get that episode once the lost TBD episode, because listen, folks, it was the best episode we ever did. There was guests. There was a lot of like great storytelling. It was so compelling. It was ridiculously compelling.
It was legitimately the most amount of guests that we've ever had.
Most amount of guests we ever had. The longest episode we ever did. I would say maybe, no, not including this one, of course, maybe the best episode we ever did. So that got lost. And then we were supposed to record another episode. And I had to go to the dentist for what I thought was like a half hour procedure that would be like, boom, zip, in and out. 3 hours later, I'm still sitting in the chair. I'm drooling. I literally have Laurence Olivier asking me, is it safe? I was like scared, ready to like run out of the chair. And so we tried to record a bit of a podcast that afternoon also, and that was a no-go. So here we are. Let's call it 11 because 11's out there in the ether.
We're going to print up with number 11. Okay. The lost episode, you'll know, is the lost episode. Uh-huh. There are some technical issues. We're still trying to... We've got the best team on it trying to manufacture it. But with this episode coming up, we're bringing back another guest because we just had so much fun. The fans were basically hounding us to get him back. So, Bill, why don't you introduce him?
Connor, once again, we have back from Squash TV. We have Paul Johnson, PJ Squash. After the last episode, there was a lot of clamoring for more PJ. Some were saying, hey, Bill, maybe you and PJ should do a show because maybe Connor's replaceable. I, of course, fought back strenuously against that because, as you know, Connor, I think you're the one who drives the show. But that aside, I'd like to welcome back Paul Johnson, PJ Squash, back to The Breakdown. Welcome, PJ.
Good afternoon, chaps. I'm happy to be back, and I'm surprised it's actually so quick that you've invited me back on the show. So last time around, obviously, didn't go quite as badly as I first feared, but... Connor, I agree. I do also feel that you're irreplaceable. So you've got my support.
Well, you're also carrying on the tradition from the last episode where you have a drink of choice in front of you.
I do. As you know, it's always 5 o'clock somewhere, and it happens to be kind of 5:15 here in London. And as you know, we previously discussed my kind of passion for Scotch, and I decided to pour a tipple of Glenlivet 15. So it was actually handed over as a gift about a week ago, and I'm just sort of working my way through it. It's a little bit more on the kind of towards the sherry flavor, but it's a nice single malt and it's very easy to drink so far.
And the big controversy, is there ice or no ice in it?
But today, I mean, just purely for Bill's benefit, I've gone sans ice. There's no ice in this one. I'm just au naturel. It's straight from the bottle into the glass.
Do you add any droplets of water to help open it up? Or?
This one, I want to try it first off neat and see how it goes. And then I'll maybe sample a bit later on with a couple of additions, maybe a little bit of water or possibly an ice cube. But I'm just tasting it as is now. And so far, so good. This is definitely going on the list.
So one question, and this came up over the weekend. So we've transitioned now that it's spring here in my area to drinking rum instead of scotch or the heavier liquors. Yeah. Controversy came up. We were drinking some pretty high-end rum the other night, and someone asked for it neat with a lime. Is that possible to drink a glass of rum neat with a lime?
I actually think it is. And if we go back to the previous podcast, you kind of educated us all how you can turn a pretty average beer into a more of a premium tasting beer by adding a lime. And you can do the same with perhaps, you know, roses do a great lime cordial. I know some people will a slight addition into a beer. And I have seen it put into sometimes neat alcohol.
Understood. But is that actually called neat? That's my question.
No.
That was the argument. That's the argument.
Now I understand. No, that's not neat. Because okay. There's an addition. So okay. As I'm taking this right now, this is neat. If you add an ice or a water to me, then you're mixing.
Okay. So even
if you're adding droplets, you would call that?
Yeah, it's a mix. Not, you're mixing. Yeah. Neat is straight out of the bottle.
That's it. Neat. It's neat. There's nothing to mess it up. Thus the word neat, right?
Right.
I'm glad we got that solved. So what was this episode going to be about? I forget.
Yeah, we're still trying to figure it out, but let me go to what the inspiration was. There was an article that was written by Andy Whip, and it was released on Squash Mad, both great website and great writer. And it was talking about jobs within the sport of squash and what the touring pros do after leaving the tour. And that got us sort of inspired to like, well, let's talk about jobs. So we're kind of like going towards like top jobs within, we're going to start first within other industries to kind of give a sort of spectrum of what else is out there. And then we'll go specifically more into like squash and how we kind of view it. And one of the hot topics of there was, where do pros, when they retire, leave their home country and maybe go someplace else? And we obviously needed to bring an expert on here. And that's why we could think of no one else better than PJ himself. So the first one we'll start off with is jobs in sports world. And Bill, I know you were kind of giving this a lot of peeking under the hood, so to speak. So why don't you kick it off?
So I think the best job in all of sports would be a scoreboard operator for a soccer team. It has to be the easiest job, right? So that would be number one. I'm not sure what the pay is, but as far as actual work involved, no offense to our footy fans out there, but scoreboard operator at a soccer game. But all joking aside, my nephew is an accountant. He's like in his 30s. He's been a vendor at Fenway Park since he was 16 years old, started selling like cotton candy and like programs and things such as that. Is now in his 30s, has been there for 15 years, and has worked his way up to selling beer, which is the pinnacle of of vendors, especially at a place like Fenway Park. So what I didn't know is, so at Fenway Park, they have 120 some odd vendors on call every night. You are a list of 120 vendors. You just show up. You don't have to like call and say, I'm coming. You just show up. And as many vendors that show up a game get put to work, depending on what they need and, you know, what type of crowd it is. And beer vendors are always at the top of the pecking order. They're the only ones who get paid a salary. Everyone else gets paid on commission. And beer vendors at Fenway get paid. If you had a guess, what would you say that a beer vendor's salary was per game?
Per game.
What does he get for a fee per game?
Yeah, I know. I was going to say, there's what, like 80 games?
82 games. Not just one game. Per. You get paid per game.
I know. I'm trying to, like, even when I'm doing the math in my head, if it's like $1,000 or $500 just to show up, like, gosh, probably way more than I would have guessed to begin with. Let's say $1,000 a game.
I'm going to go way lower. I think a lot of the people that would go along to games like that will do it because they're generally diehard fans and they have a passion for it. I'm going to go $150 a game.
PJ, very close. So $170 for the people who don't have a lot of seniority, but for the ones who have seniority, you get 180, but they make their money on tips.
Okay.
So think about like you're a vendor and what a beer costs at Fenway Park and you order four beers. Probably if it's like Yankee Stadium, it's like $12, $13 a beer at this point. You're getting tipped like $10 every time you sell a beer. So my nephew said that, you know, when he does it, he's a younger guy and he hasn't been there that long. When he does beer, he makes about 100 plus tips per night, depending on the crowd. So you walk away with like roughly about $300 if you're a vendor per night times 81 games. But you only...
That's part of $25,000 US.
As a part-time job. And you also get to watch the games. So they stop selling beer typically in the seventh inning. So if you're a Red Sox fan and he's a huge Red Sox fan, he gets basically watch every Red Sox game, including playoffs and World Series that unfortunately the Red Sox have been in quite a bit lately, especially in his lifetime. So it's a great gig. And everyone besides the beer vendor is on commission, 100% commission, no salary whatsoever. So you just get commission and tips, basically. So good gig. To me, that's always been a cool job. It's got to be hard, especially if you're carrying the beer thing around. And just know this, if you're the beer vendor and you're the hot dog vendor, you're buying this stuff. So if you're the beer guy, you're basically purchasing a crate of beer from the concession stand and then going to sell it because you need to come back with that money, obviously, right? So if you trip and fall and that beer goes flying, you're looking at like $13 to $12 a beer, you're losing out and you're paying for that out of your pocket. So that's also a reason you can't give beer away to your friends. That would be a great job, although it's probably more arduous than we think. Here's what and this is true to life story. So I applied for last week to become a Major League Baseball hot dog taster.
What?
Yep.
You're kidding
me. How?
I'm not kidding you. So it was online. Major League Baseball has authorized this, trying to increase fan engagement online and social media and things like that. Major League Baseball is the dinosaur of social media. They don't allow their clips to be shown on YouTube. They are the worst when it comes to sports. They are the worst at growing their own game, for sure. So they have a job out there that you could apply for online to be a Major League Baseball hot dog tester, in which they give you a small salary, mind you, but still a salary, and pay your travel and your entry into the games. And then you go and taste the hot dogs at, you know, the different stadiums and at different sites in different stadiums and rate the hot dogs, write a blog about them, and also do a little YouTube video describing, hey, the bun was soggy. Hey, this hot dog was good. The mustard was good. It was cold. Price-wise, it was a little overpriced. So I have applied for that job, and we'll find out May 5th. I'll find out whether I get the job or not. So
we'll see if there's a podcast number 12 then.
Yeah, exactly. Suddenly it's like, would this be retiring from?
No, put it this way. If this was a full-time job, I told my wife about this and she goes, do you mean you're quitting your job? And I was like, well, I said, if it was full-time, yeah, 100%. I mean, hot dog taster at a baseball stadium for a baseball season, I don't care what it paid me. If it was a full-time job, that'd be awesome. So yeah.
It's rumored that you're only supposed to ever eat one hot dog per year. I mean, because of what goes into these hot dogs. Well, I mean, this really could be the last time we see
him. Yeah, exactly. I think I would dive deep. I would love to do it. You know what? I may do it anyways. Even if I don't get the job, I may go do it and then submit my like reviews to these people and say, I don't know who the heck you hired, but this is what you could have had.
This is what you should have.
So, your thoughts, guys, on jobs, sports jobs?
For me, there's probably only two positions that I would look to consider if I could. First of all would be an agent for a Premier League soccer player. These guys obviously get to travel around with their players. The red carpet gets rolled out. I know that they're loathed by club managers and club owners, but the amount of money that these guys make, transfer fees and agency fees and everything else, is astronomical, absolutely ridiculous. They're also somewhat, and one of the things that does appeal to me is they're removed from the limelight. So they can travel about their business and carry on living a pretty salubrious lifestyle without the hassle of the fame and the aggravation of the recognition and that kind of thing.
What did you call their lifestyle? Salubrious? What does that mean?
Salubrious, kind of.
Connor?
No, I'm excited to learn a new word.
What does it mean? Like anonymous?
No, it's kind of extravagant. It's kind of a glamorous.
Did you make it up or is it a real word?
It's a real word. Check it out, Bill.
I will.
Maybe you don't have that in the US.
All right. Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt you, but go ahead. Salubrious. Got it.
So that would be my first option. But then if I could ever, and I actually thought about this as a kid growing up, it would be a golf caddy for somebody on the PGA Tour. And if I could choose a player, obviously it would be Tiger Woods. And, you know, look at somebody like Steve Williams, who was on Tiger's bag for a number of years and they had tremendous success together. I think the general rule of thumb is the caddy will make 10% of the purse for the player. And for a number of years, Steve Williams, as Tiger Woods' golf caddy, was the highest paid sportsman in New Zealand.
So they stopped that. Most tour players stopped that because of Tiger. Because as you know, you're a golf fan. Like when Tiger came in, the purses got raised. So, you know, it used to be 10% was the standard. So after the Tiger craze raised these, where you were winning $1 million a tournament, basically, they were starting to do contracts. And I think they've stuck with that for the most part for the higher level golfers. I think maybe the guys who don't win as much still do the 10% to the 10% of the earnings. But for the most part, like Jordan Spieth's caddy and Dustin Johnson's caddy, those guys are on contract where they get paid a certain amount a year and probably get bonuses and whatnot.
I mean, you look at DJ's, his brother is on the bag, for example. But what a lifestyle. Generally, those guys don't really follow the sun. Mm-hmm. Traveling, they're playing these phenomenal golf courses. And again, it's the lack of recognition and the lack of fame that the caddies would get with the bonus of the financial reward. That, for me, would be...
Do the caddies live the celebrious lifestyle, you think? Lubrious. Would you say, PJ?
Lubrious, yeah. It's not obviously in the realms of the player, but it's going to be up there. It's going to be a very, very good quality of life.
Do you think the work that the caddies put in is unrecognized? So I see like these, I watch so much golf and you see these guys grind over every shot and they pull these books out and they're both looking at these pads and they're like talking about 24 to cover and blah, 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 blah. And they go on and on. So like they must like do so much pre-work. Like don't these courses have like sprinkler heads, for God's sake?
I think it goes back to the point that you were saying with, it was your nephew at Fenway. There's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes that we're probably unaware of. I know Stevie Williams, for example, was on call 24/7 for somebody like Tiger, who would have been pretty demanding, I'm sure. But there's so many hats that they have to wear. They have to be mathematically extremely astute. They have to take weather conditions into consideration. They need a great memory. They need to be, you know, a mentor, psychologist, and all of these things rolled onto one, carrying the bag. They have to deal with sometimes rowdy crowds, trying to keep things quiet going on behind the scenes to make the situation as kind of plain sailing and smooth running for their player as possible.
I'd be fearful I wouldn't know how to rake the bunker properly and like the guys behind me would be pissed. I mean, you know what I mean? It's got to be like, there's got to be certain things you do there, like etiquette-wise, raking the bunker, taking the flag from the other caddy, staying out of the way. And Tiger used to famously say, and that's why he fired, remember Fluff, his first caddy, was the old man. And Fluff started to get a little too famous for his own good. And as Tiger said, he wants his caddy to show up and shut up. And Fluff wasn't doing that. Yeah. So definitely an art to it, I'm sure. And like learning the ins and outs.
Well, as you know, as you've played some golf yourself, Bill, there's plenty of, a lot of etiquette that takes place on a golf course. There's ethics and manners, and I'm sure there's a lot of common sense that has to be implemented as well. And a lot of, but that I think you'd learn as you went along and you'd find that out pretty quick.
Right.
I'm sure,
right.
You know, we've heard some horror stories of certain players being DQ'd from certain events, too many clubs in the bag, and instantly they've lost their job. And I'm sure it's pretty cutthroat as well. I'm not trying to paint an entirely glamorous image of that particular industry, but I still feel for me that would be...
Yeah, absolutely the case. The one golf story with a caddy that always sticks with me is Matt Kuchar. When he was a amateur playing in, I think it was the British Open, and it was the British Open that Justin Leonard, I believe, ended up winning. And Justin Leonard and Matt Kuchar from what I understand, still don't speak to each other because of this. And this is 20 some odd years past, that Kuchar's dad was caddying for him because he was an amateur, and I guess was doing all the things we just talked about wrong, etiquette-wise, for a caddy. And him and Leonard got into quite a few spats because I guess they played their first two rounds together or whatever it was. And Justin Leonard's not supposed to be the greatest guy in the world anyways, from what I understand. But either way, he went at it with Matt Kuchar's dad because of Matt Kuchar's dad's lack of knowledge of how to caddy on the pro tour. So that story has always scared me, that if like someone said, hey, you want to come caddy for me on a PGA Tour event? I would know that I would draw the ire of whoever was our playing partner, our opponent. So
yeah, pretty cutthroat.
Yeah. So the one other job that I looked up that looks like glamorous, but you do need to have some skill, but it actually doesn't pay too bad either because it's baseball season. It again is 162 games. So it's 8 months a year. For $70,000 a year, most Major League Baseball teams, 70 to 80 grand a year, employ a bullpen catcher. someone who literally just warms up the pitchers in the bullpen. And that's all he does. Has no chance to get into a game, is not on the roster, doesn't get any of the benefits of being a Major League Baseball player, but basically he's in the uniform warming up pitchers just because he'd probably caught in college or something like that, or just knows how to catch a ball. So that seems like that, if you had that skill set, that would be a pretty cool job to have.
It goes back to the point with your nephew. If you're a diehard fan who, without sounding too condescending, is never really going to have a chance to get out physically on the field themselves, the closeness and the association that you can have with the players on the team and the atmosphere and the vibe that goes on at Fenway, seeing what takes place behind the scenes and the real day-to-day run-ins of that kind of outfit must be amazing.
It's why Connor and I do this podcast, so we could have time with people like you, PJ, who we could otherwise we'd never actually associate with, right, at your level. So we understand. We understand exactly what you're saying, not to be condescending.
Not at all.
Well, I'm going to jump in and...
Hey, Connor, are you still here?
Yeah, I fell asleep for a little bit. No, I'm just kidding. I was actually going to give you props. I was really enjoying listening. And yours are so much more creative and sort of well thought out than mine, because mine is almost would be a business development strategist, or I love doing it in squash. And I would only imagine what it'd be like doing it for the NBA or other sports like that. So
it's every kid's dream. I mean, I know.
it's so lame by comparison. I did some other research, right?
All right.
So I was also thinking, in so many sports, being a volunteer is such a crucial role to help the event. And like, imagine being one of those roles at a big PGA event or a professional tennis event. Like, that's a really cool part to feel like you're contributing towards the event. So I'm going volunteer, but some more creative stuff.
Those events won't take place without people like you, Connor. Do you know what I mean? Your PGA Tour events, your Wimbledons, your World Cups, without good, solid, heartfelt volunteers like you.
Can you imagine though, when Connor was like in second grade and there was career day or something, and like, yeah, Connor, what do you want to be when you grow up? I want to be a volunteer and or a sports administrator.
Can I just very quickly tell one story?
Talking
about career advisors, Connor, sorry to interrupt.
No, go for it.
No, please interrupt.
So going back to, I was 14 years of age, and we were coming into the third year of our so-called senior school, and our career advisors came in to speak to pupils, so you could then dictate what career path you wanted to go down. If you wanted to go into business, certain subjects you would look to take in your final 2 years. So I sat down with my career advisor, and she sat me down and said, okay, well, I've got your scores and your grades here, and can you tell me a little bit about what area or what field you'd like to move into once you've finished high school? So I told her that I wanted to become a professional squash player. I just recently got back from the British Open final. Jahangir Khan was playing, Jahangir Khan had just beaten Chris Robertson 3-1 in the final at Wembley. And this was about 2 weeks later. And that ignited my passion and my drive to want to become a professional squash player. So I said this, I explained this to the career advisor, and I kid you not, she literally started laughing, chuckling, and said, no, come on, seriously, what is it you want to do when you grow older? And I said, no, I want to be a squash player. And she just said, well, I really think you need to look beyond that field, because there's no chance that you're going to make a career of playing squash.
Wow.
True story.
Wow.
That's amazing. Do you want to call out her name?
Give her name.
I was so deflated when I came out of there. It's like all my pipe dreams had just been completely burst.
Who is she? What's her name?
I wish I knew. I've been in therapy for years, just trying to write.
I mean, you imagine that. Now, did that fuel you more to kind of like prove her wrong? Or
listen, I've always been like that. If people ever kind of put me down or said, you can't do this, you can't do that, if I genuinely believed it myself, that would kind of motivate me to prove them wrong. But to this day, since graduating from that school, when a lot of teachers said the same thing, I've never once been back, because I don't want to give them the pleasure of somebody who's done relatively well in a sport to go back in and explain, you know, how it happened. But
I love the grudge. Yeah. Connor knows I'm the and this will be a separate podcast. I am the number one grudge holder in America by far. So I love the grudge.
It's like ridiculous, like over a slice of cheese that was like 25 cents slice of cheese, and she would never go back in there. Like if this was a deli, you'd be like, you're dead to me.
Yeah, it's a longer story than that.
Yeah.
But as Connor rightly points out, all of my grudges hurt me more than they hurt the people I have a grudge against. Because for the most part, the people I have a grudge against have no idea that I have a grudge against them.
Probably best.
It's so true. Okay. So I knew, just to close out my section, I knew I was coming in limping a little bit, right? So what I figured I'd do is also try and find some other interesting angles here. And this is within soccer or football, was some jobs that you might not know about within the Premier League that are well-paid salaries. And there's a top 10 list that was out there, and I'm just going to read a few of them, but a throw-in coach, like specifically for set plays, there was like a throw-in coach, and they were saying how much of an impact that could have. So really getting to the level of specialization, and just shows how much of these clubs are just like a machine and that they need every single role spelled out. So along that, a player liaison officer, which was basically a fixer or a therapist or like executive assistant, but they start assigning them to the players.
Are they individual to the player, or would they work for a team? Or
so like a throw-in coach would like coach the whole team. The player liaison would get almost either one-to-one depending on the star, or like one to like two or three. But yeah.
If they get into trouble, they like make sure that like the newspapers don't get a hold of the story, that type of thing? Or like get their life together and get them an apartment and cook for them?
It sounds like a little bit of everything. They're even expanding certain roles to include player finances, and just really, they saw that these players who are coming from so many different walks of life, I mean, when you get this level of attention and celebrity and money, you kind of want that go-to person. So it's as much as like a, I would say, an executive assistant role, but like more than that. So
could you be a liaison to a sports administrator, Connor? That'd be like your real dream job.
Oh my gosh. I mean, if I'm trying to level up, for sure. Coffee maker. So this is, I think, driven by some of the top coaches and their love for coffee. And they were just kind of like making this one guy who's makes them all coffee. And so, you know, I think that was kind of,
wow.
Is that a well-paid?
No, I don't think it's well-paid at all.
I heard you get paid beans. You get paid in beans.
But
it ground you down though too. So
good one. Boom, boom.
Bill, those were really good.
Thank you. Thank you. If you're able to filter your thoughts, then it also helps.
That's a good one. Any more?
Something about drips. I'm not sure.
You are a coffee connoisseur.
Yeah.
Sleep coach.
Huh.
And so they would go to the extreme of like a sleep coach comes in, fits out all the players at home, whether they need kitted out for like, this is sheets, this is what's the optimal sleep temperature, pillows. But literally, they also have a on the road strategy that then they will ship linens, everything you need. And then each player's room gets made up to that specification. When you're looking for every edge in sports, like, I mean, and sleep is so under recognized. So yeah, that's a big one.
I appreciate that, but with all due respect, it can't be that difficult to figure out or make your own bed. Or, I mean, is it really that? I understand where you're coming from, but I mean, that's like a complete and utter mismanagement of finance there.
You told me one, though, that was fascinating to me.
Well, which one popped out for you?
Brother.
Yeah.
You had one that was called Brother. There's a job title called Brother.
So what they were highlighting was the brother of some of these soccer stars literally get paid salaries.
Connor, I asked you this. Did you have to actually be the person's brother?
Yeah, that's what they were addressing.
Okay. So it's kind of a finite skill set. You need to be like a nice guy who's able to help somebody, but you also need to have a brother who's like a good enough to be playing in the Premier League. So,
and also have influence over that person.
Yeah. Better chance of you being a volunteer, I think,
There's a number of current players in the Premier League who have family members acting on their behalf as their agent and doing
all really?
This. Yeah, no, it's good. Because then there's obviously a lot of skullduggery and a lot of mismanagement of finances, shall we say, with some of the agents and hidden costs that get involved. And a lot of the players, if they're not careful, can get ripped off.
Yeah.
It's very much a dog-eat-dog kind of world. So to avoid that potential issue, then these players will bring in. I know I won't mention any names, but there's some very big players in the UK right now whose brother and actually his mother are acting on his behalf and helping him organise a lot of his off-the-pitch kind of responsibilities. And they organise his finances, his contracts and everything else. So keeps everything in house, and they can be a little bit more trustworthy than some of the agents. So
why wouldn't you mention their name? Is it like hidden that they're doing this?
No, it's completely open. I just don't want to throw anybody under the bus.
Is this within squash or are you talking about soccer?
Within soccer. This is in the UK.
Bill, just move on. Just move on.
I'll move on. I thought it was somebody in squash too. I was all excited. We're going to break some news here.
I'm not a grudge, Bill.
All right. So let's get to our sport, squash.
Yeah.
And as you look, if you go on any squash website, there's always a job opportunity site. So we were thinking about, if you thought about it, what are the top jobs in squash? And as specific as we want to be, or as non-specific as you want to be, because in the United States right now, college squash is probably the biggest growing aspect of squash in the country. And Yale University, we had Dave Talbot on this podcast, it seems like forever ago. And he left Yale after 38 years at Yale, leaving a job opening, which to me, in the world of squash in the United States, I can't imagine there'd be a more sought after job in the United States than the head squash coach at Yale University. And just thinking about the top jobs available in squash, is there a job available in squash right now in the United States or worldwide that is more prestigious and would be more sought after than the head coaching job for men and women at Yale University?
If you're asking me that as a question, is there a job available?
Mm-hmm.
I would probably say no. I would agree with you. I think given the prestige, the benefits, the facilities that you have there, the contacts and the networking that you would have at your disposal in a situation like that at Yale, I would think you would be really hard pushed to find a better gig.
Right, right. Pretty incredible, right? In the whole world.
Yeah, as far as squash goes, yeah. I think there's a lot of upsides, but there's a lot of very tough aspects to that particular job. Having to deal with, let's for argument's sake, say 15 players in the men's, 15 on the women's, you've got 30 different personalities. In my experience, if you have a team of 15 men, 15 women, if you can get 8 players that are genuinely serious about improving their game during their time at college, then I think you've had a result. Whereas I think the way it is at the moment, a lot of the players that get not only to Yale, but into these universities, that once they've achieved that particular goal, they cruise. And I don't honestly, very few players, there are exceptions, but for the majority, I'd say very few players actually come out of college better players than when they went in.
Right, right.
That's just my opinion. So you've got that dynamic to deal with as well, going back to the responsibility of a head coach at Yale. Some of these foreign kids coming over from different cultures, different lifestyles into the American system, it's got to be challenging for them to adapt and adjust. I'm sure there's a lot of juggling that has to be done.
I'm sure that's the most difficult part of a job, any coaching job in college or high school is the personalities. College especially, because these kids are away from home. So you're almost, I mean, I forget which AD told me, I mean, you're basically having thousands of kids sleep over at your house. You're responsible for these kids. They're on your campus. You're responsible. They're 18 years old. A lot of them had seen now getting freedom for the first time in their lives and are going to take full advantage of it. So dealing with the personalities is got to be rough. I mean, and also now with the admissions has to be, you know, thinking of the pitfalls of the job, because there's a lot of pros of the job. Number one, the hours aren't bad. Number two, the time that you actually are coaching, not a lot, especially in Ivy.
A lot of off time. Yeah.
Yeah. Ivy League schools only allow a certain amount of practice time. Other college conferences also restricted, but I'm thinking Ivy League actually sticks to their restrictions on like SEC football and things such as that. So dealing with that, but the admission side of it, the recruiting side of it, worst part of it to me would be the fundraising side of it. Having to ask for money constantly and raise money constantly. To me, that would be the biggest drawback of it. That being said, every job in squash has its drawbacks. To me, being the head coach at Yale University, I mean, I agree with you, PJ. I said, I can't imagine. I wonder how many people are actually applying for it. Do you think it's like 100 people?
I don't think it will be that many, because I don't think many understand the magnitude or the significance of the position.
Mm-hmm.
But anybody, especially in the US, that knows anything, anybody that's involved in squash in the US obviously understands the affiliation with college squash. They'll be interested in that particular position. But I don't think it would be as high as that many.
Okay.
Those numbers will whittle down very, very quickly. I don't think there's going to be many genuinely in the running for that particular gig.
I feel like I'm always shocked at how many people apply who are woefully unqualified, and they figured, why not? So I don't know how many will apply, but the pool of who would be a good fit and could do the role is very small.
Yeah.
But I also wanted to expand this, because you said, and the way that you framed this was the jobs available right now. And there was one position that was recently filled. Again, I feel it's in a different sector. It's still coaching, but it's in the private club sector. And that's with the University Club of New York head pro position, where Damian Mudge retired. And again, these jobs don't come up that often either. And so that one was actually just recently filled.
I think that got filled recently, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. That.
My name names?
Yeah, for sure. I think Susie Pierpont is now the head coach there. Yeah. The private club jobs in the United States are good clubs are few and far between. And again, I think talking about the Yale University job, I think there was probably more applicants for the U Club of New York job than there would be for the Yale University job, just because of it's New York. People think it's money. And some of the money that can be made as a coach and at one of these private clubs in a big city is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, there's substantial. I think if you're looking at criteria, a lot of these college squash positions, they all stipulate that you have to have had a role within college squash already. So right there, you narrow down that candidate by a lot.
Yeah. So you're saying like a Nick Matthew couldn't come in and apply for the Yale job and be a favorite to get it because he has no college coaching experience. Not that Nick Matthew applied for the job. I'm just throwing his name out there because he's recently retired. He does some camp coaching and things such as that. And he's as big a name for a retired squash player in the world.
I think certain schools make exceptions to it, but that's on the sort of qualification list of most of these things, which actually kind of ties into what sparked this was the article. But like, you know, you have John White, Terry Linku,
Palmer,
all who...
Hansley, Martin.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
So none of them had college coaching experience before they had got their current jobs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So that might be changing. As you said, it also might lead to exceptions. So, I mean, there's other jobs out there. I mean, so we're staring in the face of somebody who many think have the best job in squash. I queried your partner via messenger, what does he think the best job in squash is? And he says he has the best job in squash. And that's Joey Barrington says the best job in squash is a PSA TV announcer.
I'm going to have to agree. I'm just looking at my own situation. I've been in the States for 18 years now, and I've worked as a private coach to a number of different families over the years. Some amazing families, and I'm still in contact with the families and the kids, and I've seen them grow up from the ages of 12 up to 30. I've been to some of their weddings and so on and so forth. So some lifelong friends that I've made through that particular field, to see them develop and evolve, privately coaching them, being in the US, being financially well rewarded for that work.
Able to live the salubrious lifestyle, correct?
Salubrious. Not extravagant, but nice and healthy and just a good quality of life. I've been so fortunate to meet so many great people in the States. They've welcomed me into their families like you in a way that I never felt would have been possible. So I've been really lucky in that respect. To coincide that as well with being an ex-professional player who still feels very much part of the game with the commentary. You're traveling to the tournaments, you're watching the best players in the world. So you almost feel as though you're still involved and you feel as though you're still on tour in a funny kind of way. You don't have the strains and the stresses on the body and mentally with the training and the competing and the playing. And you're sitting there with your best pal having a chat about a sport that you still love. It doesn't really get any better. For me personally, and I would agree exactly with what Joey's saying. You know, Joey and I have been best friends for nearly 25 years now. And just to be in that whole environment and feel part of that, both of us are extremely blessed. We feel extremely blessed.
I don't know if it's the whiskey or not, but you're getting a little misty talking about this.
No, it's true. It's true. It's all part of
I'm comfortable with it.
It's nice. But I mean, I stopped playing through injury back in 2002. So I was then very much removed away from the tour, but then to kind of come back in and still feel squash has been a part of my life since I was 11, so just over 30 years. And I'm still heavily involved now as one of the vehicles, and it doesn't get any better, really. So
if Joey quit today and you had to do the rest of the tournaments for the rest of your life with Lee Drew, would you quit? Would you still get misty about it?
It just got better because I won't have to share a room with him anymore, listen to his snoring and his habits and listen to him whinging about life at home and blah, 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 blah.
It's always good to hear that with somebody when you think that they have a great job and you're like, man, that seems like such an awesome job. It is cool to hear that you actually think that, because for the most part, people are like, yeah, it seems great from the outside, but, and then they hear a bunch of buts. But to hear your enthusiasm and to actually see you tear up talking about your job at PSA TV is, while uncomfortable, was somewhat heartwarming.
I would not change my job for the world.
Awesome. That is awesome.
When I was thinking through this too, I also had PSA Squash TV commentators in my top three.
So I've been lucky enough to be an MC at some squash tournaments. So it's a cool job. It's hard. It's a lot harder than people think, because I talked to Jenny Dunkoff about it actually. And she said, being an MC is harder than playing, probably not physically, but mentally, to sit there in an arena for like 8 matches a session. And especially the early rounds when some of these matches are just so one-sided and people are getting crushed, and you have to go out and ask these questions of these players. And as PJ, you know, I think we've talked about this, you know exactly what the answers are going to be. Nothing ever changes. You say, oh, you know, tell me how you prepared for that match. And instead of them saying truly like, well, I didn't really have to prepare because I've beaten them 162 straight times, and so I'll save my preparation for the later rounds when the matches get tough. They say, oh, you know, yes, I played Joni. We've been playing since we were kids, and she's always tough, and she always gives me a good battle. And
we know the script.
Yeah, you know the script. So as the rounds go on, you interview these same people over and over and over again until you've interviewed them 5 times before they get to the final. So it's fun. It's a blast being there, especially you get to travel. I got to go to Cairo a couple times. I've done the U.S. Open down in Philly for years. It is a blast, but man, that is one of those jobs that people say looks like so much fun. It is, but holy cow, is it difficult to do for a whole week of that. And I think anybody who does it on a regular basis, I give Jenny especially, because Jenny and Gilly, I think, are the best to do it. And I give them full credit because their enthusiasm never wavers, never wavers.
Well, I would imagine that's the same challenge for PJ and Joey watching this early round of matches, but talking for the entirety of the match.
Well, you could tell when PJ and Joey like lose a little bit of interest because there is just dead silence and all you hear is the bump. The ball being whacked, and every once in a while, like you could tell, like they probably both look up for their phones. Oh, point is over. Oh, okay.
I will tell a very quick story. Joey and I got this gig off the back of Joey. Joey's offered the job initially. We got asked to go to commentate at the Commonwealth Games in Delhi in 2010. It was funded by the BBC. It was a well-paid gig. We got flown over on Kingfisher, the beer owner. He opened up an airline, so we got flown out first-class travel.
Did you fly in the 16-ounce bottle or the 12-ounce bottle?
We've turned up to day one of play at the Commonwealth Games, and I think, I can't remember how many, I think there were 12 matches on the first day. Joey and I are used to normally doing 8 with the PSA, but they had 12 matches because it's such a the size of the draw. And we went in for a meeting for the producer of the show at the time, and she said, right, so cameras will start rolling at noon, and we are just going to continue the camera rolling, and the show will basically carry on the entire time. So the first match of the day was Nick Matthew against some poor guy from Kenya, I think it was. The match was over in 21 minutes, but we had to allow 45-minute slots per match.
No.
Basically, Joey and I had to wing it the entire 24 minutes remaining of the show until the start of the next game.
Wow.
Oh my gosh.
This was for the first day. We completed the first day, banging on the door of the producer, and we said, listen, there's no way that we can continue like this because we're just filling dead time. They just had the ident on the screen. There was nothing to actually talk about, but Joey and I were still having to just babble on about complete nonsense.
Is there anywhere to watch that, like on YouTube or anything like that?
I hope not.
That's hilarious. You should just start like reading Shakespeare or something.
Oh, yeah. I mean, needless to say, Joey's head would have fallen off his shoulders by that.
That's hilarious. Well, the other two that I would throw, and there's so many, I think, jobs that are great within the sport of squash, but high school and college coaching, I think, as we already identified, like is just such an important role and the impact you can have on the community. But also, when I was thinking about this, I also think being a touring professional, you are the best of the best on the planet. You're going for that. And there's obviously such a mountain to climb in order to get where it's even makes sense financially, but you're traveling around the globe. You're getting exposure to so many different communities. So I put that in the sort of my top three.
Yeah, you're playing in any sport, and people always, you know, you always talk to people like, hey, this person works for the Yankees or this person works for the NBA. And for the most part, unless you're a player, it's a job. They call them players for a reason because of the word play. That's such a huge difference. So monetarily speaking aside, yes, I think obviously being the athlete on any pro sport is the top job. Nothing, I don't think anything could compete with it. No. There's a reason. The rest of them are just jobs. Those guys are actually out there playing. And you also got to realize if it weren't for them, the other jobs wouldn't exist. So,
no, that's true.
What else is on your guys' list?
One I would have put in there, going back to Bill, you've done a MC at the US Open and a few sort of events. I think John Nimick has a great job. And I'm a big, big fan of Mr. Nimick. He's, what he's put back into the sport from a player standpoint is arguably the best in the business. The events that he runs, the locations, his attention to detail, his care and concern, genuine concern for the players' welfare. He wants them to stay in nice hotels. He wants them to receive the best treatment that they possibly can get. You use Tournament of Champions, for example, hands down my favorite tournament on the tour. The way that Joey, Lee Drew, Vanessa Atkins and myself get looked after, because John appreciates the fact that we're the voice for his particular product. We're the ones who are talking about it and commentating on the sport. He always does his best to take care of us and look after us. He does an unbelievable event in San Francisco.
Yeah, the NetSuite Open. Yeah.
The NetSuite Open, he does a great event down there. Given his knowledge of the game and the sport, because he competed and played a good level himself, I think that gives him a bit of an advantage compared to most other promoters, because he sees both sides of it. He sees the business aspect, but he also sees what the players, to create an environment where the players can play their best. And that's why we have so many classic matches that have come out of the TOC. The timing's brilliant. They've had a nice break over the Christmas period. The atmosphere that's created at Grand Central Terminal. There may be more fans in Egypt, but at some of their events, but it's a knowledgeable crowd, and the crowds in New York will respect and appreciate good squash regardless of who's playing. Sometimes there can be a bit of a bias if you go to some of the events over in Egypt, in my opinion. I've heard strokes being clapped and balls being hit out of court that have been applauded by the crowd, which I'm not a fan of. But what John Nimick creates in the US, for me, has got to be one of the best jobs in the game.
And I think it comes through when you talk to John and when you see him, if you're sitting up and like sitting on one of the seats in the back and kind of watch him a bit, just see how he operates during the event, you can tell he loves the event. It's not a business. Well, it is a business to him, literally, but it's not a business to him. It's his love. And it comes across that in his events, the play is the thing. The players are the thing, because he realizes what goes on in that court. If that doesn't go well and those players aren't happy, everything else doesn't matter. And in other events, that's not the case. A lot of the peripheral stuff takes precedent, and it's like, oh, the matches just happen to be going on around the tournament. And for him, no, the matches are the thing. I see him interact with people. It could be day one. It could be day seven. It could be day 10. He's still the same person, same enthusiasm. He always has a smile on his face. He always has a time for everyone, because everyone at those events, in every squash event, thinks that they're best friends of everyone. And that, like, hey, you should recognize and talk to me. And you know what? John does that. Be it somebody he probably doesn't even know their name, to be it like the most prolific name or the biggest sponsor, treats them all well. And it comes out and you see it. You could just see it and watch it.
On your point there, Bill, what I think as well John does another very good job of is involving the players. He gets them to play their part as well. He invites them along to donate some of their time to hit with some of the patrons or hit with some of the kids or some of the sponsors. I think there needs to be more of that. I think it would be easier to approach people to support and fund some of these events if there were more players' parties where you could get the tour players to interact with some of these sponsors and make them feel a bit more of a part of the tour. And John always hosts events where there will be that kind of interaction going on. And I think that's a really important part of his events. The players don't mind doing it because they get well rewarded and they know they get well looked after. So it's a trade-off.
Right, right.
He does that brilliantly.
Agreed, agreed.
Yeah, he has set the bar high. Mm. Yeah. Very high, premium quality event. And, you know, having seen and worked a little bit with him, he's also so amazing in so many different areas, everything from broadcasting rights to sponsorship to marketing. and obviously the logistics of running the event. He's multi-talented and all that. I was just, as we were talking about this, I just had the thought pop in, like, imagine if the tournament champions had never taken place and wasn't on the tour, how much of a hole that would leave for the sport. I mean, the amount of times I've heard, I think similar to what you said, PJ, of what inspired you to become a professional squash player with the British Open, the amount of US players who have even thought about it because of TOC or other players wanting to play on that stage, like, it's been a huge driver for the sport.
Yeah. Just as an example, you've got Timmy Brownell. I'm not sure what year he's at now. He must be coming close to graduation, Timmy, but he got to play on the glass court, actually played very well given the occasion on that glass court. So, and his folks came down to watch. That for him must have just been such an iconic moment. I saw Ali Farag compete on the court before he graduated from Harvard. Amanda Sobey was on there. So to get a taste of that stage, I mean, if that doesn't get the juices going and fuel you with drive and desire, then I'm not sure what else will. But that TOC was a perfect platform to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I think that that speaks to our point of, like, being the athlete is the best job in sports. There's no question about it. We could talk about our dreams of being volunteers in sports management majors, Connor, but being the athlete,
he's all about the, he's a giver. He's a giver. He's a generous kind of.
Yes, he is. I can't identify with that. So it's a total mystery to me. So wrapping this up, any last thoughts there, Connor?
Well, I will say that it's been exciting. We kicked this off with the roles in other sports, and you look at those industries as compared to squash as an industry, just how much more robust it is. But it's showing over the past 10 years or 20 years just how much the squash industry is growing and how many more roles there are available. So, you know, you can be an administrator, you can get involved in media, manufacturing. You know, a lot of focus normally goes towards the coaching because that just seems like the easy or the most natural off-ramp from of where to go. But event management, what we talked about with what John Nemec has done and what a key role that is, club management, being a squash retailer, and obviously a huge driver of growth of jobs in the US has been with the SCA youth programming. So, I mean, they have over 200 people employed across the country. So,
and I think the one thing we didn't mention, which is really, really kind of starting actually, is neither one of us, Connor, mentioned podcaster in squash being a job. And although the remuneration obviously isn't where we want it to be right now, the gratification, I may start getting a little PJ like weepy talking about podcasting. Podcasting, hopefully, as the sport gets bigger, will become a larger factor in squash. Other sports, there's podcasts that drive sports. There's Yankee podcasts, there's baseball podcasts, there's football podcasts, there's specific podcasts about every football team, every soccer team, you name it. So there's no reason that squash podcasting can't become big. And then maybe when that is the case, when we talk about this 10 years down the road, I will actually get weepy. And we'll be able to live the salubrious lifestyle that all podcasters are entitled to.
It's hard to beat his last word, PJ, but I'm going to give you the opportunity.
There's not really much more for me to say. I'm fortunate enough to see all angles. And currently, I have to be selfish and say that I probably have the best job in the world. I'm still watching the best players in the world. I'm working with some great kids, some great families. And I've got Joey Barrington, my sidekick, who's there. We're traveling around to all these lavish locations. And I get invited onto great shows like...
Like, what's the name of this one again?
What's the name of this podcast, PJ? Because we know, PJ, we've been reading, you're going to be a podcast guest. Like, there's podcasts coming out we've been reading about, and they are trumpeting you as one of their celebrity guests. So this could be your last visit here because you may blow up on that podcast.
No, this is all right. This is Squadcast, and this is, don't worry, I know where I am.
This is actually The Breakdown.
This is The Breakdown. The Squadcast is the actual platform you're doing it on.
Okay. All right. I've just been inundated with podcasts.
All good.
All right. Well, yeah. Hey, thank you for participating on the Squadcast. We look forward to the next episode.
It's actually not a bad name.
It's not a bad name. Maybe The Breakdown was a mistake on our part. Yeah. Not as memorable. All right, guys. All right. Another great episode. We appreciate it. PJ, look forward to seeing you soon.
Hey, quick time out to hear a word from our sponsor.
Bia Sports shoes are designed for racket sport players by racket sports players, with the knowledge that if a shoe can withstand the rigors of squash, then it will have no problem holding up for any other indoor court sport. No matter what your sport, the Bia Force X is the performance shoe of choice for competition at the highest level.
So it would mean a lot if you go to biasports.us. That's B-I-A sports with an S dot U-S. Check out their website. But even better, take their new Bia Force X
for a test drive.
We're back. Our favorite segment. It's been far too long. It is time for the fan follow-up. How excited are you?
I'm very excited. Didn't want to put this out in public, but the real reason we haven't done a show in like 6 months is because we were just waiting for some follow-up, because, you know, fan follow-ups are our favorite segment and we didn't get any follow-up. So we said, you know what? F the fans. If they're not going to follow up, then we won't do a show. So we held out as long as we could. Then we realized if we did that longer, we would never have another show. So here we are with the fan follow-up.
I don't know if that's entirely, that's certainly a version of the truth. I don't know if it's the truth, but
yeah, it's not 100% the version of the truth, but
yeah, here's how I actually look at it. We got a lot of follow-up. We put out one of our favorite shows today, definitely top 10, right? And that was with PJ.
Yes. Yes. And it was our 10th show, too. So
it was our 10th show. It was our 10th show. So it's definitely in the top 10.
So we
a lot of people reached out. So what do we get?
We got a few fan follow-ups. You know what? I tend to exaggerate. So we did get a few fan follow-ups. Eric from New York City. He did not really follow the scotch and the whiskey, because he said, as like you, he's more of a Malbec Shiraz connoisseur. But he was interested in the talk about the actual squash talk, which I guess some people actually listen to instead of just listening to us go on about things that had nothing to do with squash. He was interested in Assals. It's been so long since we did that episode. We actually talked about like Mustafa Assal and Gaultier. That was like the squash topic.
Just for a little refresher to everyone out there.
Just for a little refresher for you people who can't remember from 3 months ago. He thinks the reason that Gaultier gets a pass on his behavior is because fans are nostalgic for him. And he's like looked at, which is, that's what we've said. I mean, we also think there's a racial aspect of it, but he thinks it's nostalgia and fans like giving him a pass because he's done so much for the game, which, fair enough.
I think there is an element there of newcomers are always kind of getting more scrutiny, but I also agree that there's a racial component that may be at play. We don't know.
It's pretty blatant, but we can't say that we know. How about that? That's fair, right? So Joey from the UK, Joey loved the show. He happens to be friends with PJ. They're close, I guess. I don't know what the relationship is, but
Joey something. Joey, is that a fake name?
I don't know. Is Joey JB or something his initials are? But the key with that is he had no comment at all. I mean, he loved the show, misses PJ, blah blah blah. He gets weepy too when they talk about each other. It's really a weird dynamic between those two. I can't quite.
I think in this case, should we break protocol? And we try not to say last
name. No. Can't say the last name. Can't say the last
name.
Really? I don't want to get sued. What if Joey from UK is listening right now? And you know, he realizes like who we're talking about. But either way, Joey from the UK, who I may or may not have had an incident, a food incident with, had no comment on the on Foodgate, if you will, so which to me is very telling. So he was very adamant in talking.
And he has inside knowledge on Foodgate.
He has inside knowledge. Some say he may have the most inside knowledge besides me. There were two people who were the closest to that situation. Joey from the UK and me, even though we're not going to say his name.
We won't. Almost no last name at this point.
Joey from UK.
Joey
from UK said no comment on the food. So there you go. Simba from New York City is just getting into the podcast. He said he loved the PJ episode. He was boys with PJ when they both PJ was in Boston and Simba was working in Boston. So they raised the roof and they had quite a few drinks together. So Simba was said that was a compelling listen, and he's catching up on all the TBD shows and is enjoying them very much. Our favorite fan follow-up was Craig from Annandale on Hudson. He said the episode on spirits is, if you will, got him so thirsty that at 2 p.m. he rushed home and got drunk. So, you can't say much more than that. That means we're doing our job if somebody does that. If we made somebody, compelled somebody, like in our pizza episode, I was hoping like afterwards people would want to go out and get pizza. You know, I'm talking about burgers, people want burgers. We talk about squash occasionally, people may want to go to play squash. But if we could talk about booze in that and compel someone like a pretty stable guy to leave his job, leave his office at 2 o'clock in the afternoon to go get drunk. It's pretty good.
I mean, another way of phrasing that is like he was so inspired, he was moved to go enjoy his own libations.
Absolutely. So Annandale, by the way, and again, this shows how long ago this episode took place. So Annandale, for those people who don't know, and I think I tried to tell you at the time. Do you want me to go into it or no?
Are you kidding me? No.
No. Okay.
Is this going to be the Dickie?
So it's G Gordon Liddy. So,
yes.
Okay. So G Gordon Liddy, RIP.
Or, Or if you want to tell it and leave it in here, and no, then we can do this appointment viewing test. Like, I'm more than happy to do that.
It just depends whether like our age group is listening. You know, people, if anybody's like, who knows what who Steely Dan is, like, it's a great rock and roll group. The members of Steely Dan went to school at Annandale and Hudson, and the famous song "Never Going Back to My Old School" Annandale is mentioned, and is about them getting arrested for smoking the evil cabbage, or whatever they call it, the evil weed, the devil's lettuce, and getting arrested by the famous G. Gordon Liddy, who was the attorney general of Poughkeepsie at the time, I believe it was. And in the song "Never Going Back to My Old School," they refer to Daddy G. And Daddy G is G. Gordon Liddy, who just passed away, R.I.P. So there you go. That was it. Just a little story, little
better than the 30-minute diatribe last time.
Well, because Donald Fagen and Donald Fagen like toasted G. Gordon Liddy's death, and it was a big controversy on the internet. Blah 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 blah. But you know what, Connor, if you have no interest in that kind of stuff, then I can't help you, because that's what life is all about.
There's only a limit to the river I can go to.
That's fair. That's fair enough. Right. So, big announcement we have. So,
exciting.
This is exciting. So, because having PJ on, as much as Connor and I like to think that we're the star attractions of this show, and we think that people are compelled to listen to us for some reason, PJ being on the show elicited more response than any, not necessarily on the fan follow-up, but just people talking and people on the internet and downloads, everything that, the podcast metrics. PJ pushed the needle on this show. So, he has agreed to
harsh negotiations.
Very harsh. I mean, back and forth. Yeah. There was agents involved. There was a union issue that we had to deal with.
I'm glad you got it all cleared.
We did get it all cleared. So PJ is going to be on our show. Our show plans to come out every 2 weeks.
Recurring
segment. We don't have a name for it yet. But if you have a name for it, a suggestion, Squash Radio at gmail.com or squadcast@gmail.com, according to PJ. He's so enamored with our podcast that he thought it was called Squadcast, which literally is the name of the software that we do the podcast on. He goes, "Oh, I love your, well, you heard him. I love this. It's Squadcast," which is a really cool name.
I know, it is pretty.
So we are, all joking aside, we're looking forward to having PJ on there. He's very compelling. He's very good at this. He always has some great stories.
Yeah.
He has been inside squash from its, when it first came to the public mainstream, really. I mean, he's been around for so long. So he'll have some good, what we'll do is we'll probably give him 15, 20 minute segment on his own. And if he wants us involved with it, we will be. Otherwise,
just turn the mic over, PJ talk.
PJ talk. Yeah. So, maybe that PJ.
Oh, talk. That's there. PJ talk.
PJ talk. PJ instead of, yeah. How about put on your PJs? Okay. All right. No go. Okay.
No, I was writing it down. Put on your PJs.
Put on your PJs.
And then, it didn't make the cut. I'm sorry.
Exactly. So, we look forward to that. Every 2 weeks, Connor will aspire to get this episode out. Technical difficulties and dental work aside. So another great episode, and, shouts, and I know she has been missing to me. So shouts to Kaylee. Hey, Kaylee. So then we can leave it on that note. And Connor, I look forward to seeing you on the next episode of The Breakdown.
The Breakdown. And don't forget, reach out to us at squashradio@gmail.com. Look forward to it.
Thanks, Connor. Have a good one.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.